CRS, we challenged him. I said, look, well, you said you were a Christian. How can you practice polygamy? You know, and he finds that difficult to explain. But we look at all the verses, we come to the New Testament and all of that, and he goes out every day as an evangelist, he preaches and so on and so forth. You know, I find it a bit difficult. Is it because of this control thing? Is that where, you know, is that the root of the problem?
Well, talking about polygamy in the first instance, actually, I don't believe in it, but I cannot say a Christian must necessarily be a mono, because there is nowhere it is stated in the Bible. And when you look at Paul writing to Timothy, Paul was pointing to Timothy to say, look, if you want to be a bishop, you must be husband of one wife, and you must put your house in order, you must do this. And Paul outlined the criteria, which included husband of one wife. Well, before Paul could say that, that was the criteria for a bishop, or call it a priest, any priest. But Paul was exclusive there. He didn't say, if you want to be a Christian, you must be husband of one wife. Well, so apparently, during the time of Paul, when he was writing, there must have been loads of the people that were polygamists.
Well, if we compare scriptures with scriptures, I mean, Christ himself did say that in the beginning he made them, you know, male and female, therefore for this cause a man should leave his father and mother.
Yes. Those are generalized statements which cannot be put together to say this is the law. When you look at the Ten Commandments, there is none that says thou shalt not marry two wives. Now, let me take my father. My grandfather was a Muslim. My father was the first generation of Christians. Now, my father had two wives before he was baptized. When he was baptized, he was not allowed to take communion because he was a polygamist, and he was instructed, not only him, many other people in the church, to throw away the other wives and retain one and marry one. Well, to me, that is wickedness. I cannot see the love of God operating there. Well, how can you?
Well, you see, sorry, I'm not the founder of Redeemed Church of God, Redeemed Christian Church of God, who myself was an illiterate person. His background is a Malad background. He was married to two wives before he founded RSCCP. And after a while, as he studied the scriptures, he said he felt the Holy Spirit saying to him that what he's done was wrong and that he needed to make restitution. Now, what he did was he spoke with his first wife, which was then were, you know, living with him at home. And they agreed, well, in this instance, it looks unfair to ask one person to go. Now, what would they do? Call the younger wife. Say to her, whatever you want in the house, take by way of compensation, you know. And then he and the first wife went out, and by the time they came back, you know, the younger wife had helped herself with whatever she felt she wanted and all of that. And basically, from the account that I read, you know, stripped the house bare and left. You know. And that was the way he addressed it.
Yeah, because of this, you see the AIC, the independent, the African independent churches, those that I describe as Ethiopianism, that is the very, or one of the very reasons why they broke away from the main church, because you visit their churches today, they allow polygamy because there is no definitive proof in the Bible suggesting that polygamy is evil? And if it is, why would God continually say and be proud to say, I am the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob? Was God uncivilized when he was saying it? So has God become civilized in the 21st century?
Well,
or what are we saying?
Theologians will argue for a dispensational kind of thing. You know, I mean,
even God said he blessed David, he blessed Solomon with many wives and even many concubines, but David was punished not because he was a polygamist, but because he went out to take somebody else's wife and killed him.
What the CNS basically says is that the Christian tradition of one man, one wife is a man-made thing, not rooted or grounded in scriptures.
Well, I will personally say that. It is a European cultural thing, not an African. Africans have been polygamous for generations before Christianity. Christ cannot come. Christ said, I have not come to destroy, but to fulfill the law. So Christ cannot come and say, oh, no. Everywhere, whether you are white or black, you must be mono.
I think this discussion just raises, again, the whole question of control. Because clearly, I mean, of course you have a point, and there are people even in the mainstream churches who will defend polygamy in an African situation. And, you know, I've heard this many times. But and it doesn't really just, it's not just a matter of polygamy, propitiation of the spirits. All the things which were, or do you venerate the ancestors, or do you go so far as to worship them? So all these things which are part of African culture, I mean, again and again, churches must come up against the question of control.
Yeah, we try.
When you become a heretic,
when
you get thrown out.
But surely,
well, that is what we will not do.
Okay.
Did Christ not say, Christ gave a parable where people say, oh, master, did you not plant a flower here? How come with, and Jesus said, leave them alone till the day of harvest. And on the day of harvest, the goats and the sheep will be separated. Now, you refer to Jesus of Onyebo, for instance. Many people believe that this guy had a traditional means of putting spell on people, and they followed him blindly. Well, again, I will apply the norm that we should judge not. Let us leave that to God. Because nobody can do that and escape judgment.
So John, let me get this right. So in the AIC and the small splinter groups within it, it's free for all. I mean, is it free for all?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. You see, one thing you must remember is, you see somebody who you think is wicked or is evil or polygamous and so on, and suddenly the Holy Spirit is working through him. So you begin to wonder, if the Holy Spirit must be operating, shouldn't the Holy Spirit go to the righteous people? I mean, when there was this outbreak of the Spirit at Sousa Street, the Welsh revival, I mentioned the Welsh revival, which was strangled. The Welsh revival happened in the unexpected environment. The leader of that revival was somebody with half-baked education. And people did not respect him. The people humiliated him, and he was driven into confusion. He left West and became a refugee in Leicester until eventually the poor guy died away. You see, we can never explain how the Holy Spirit operates. If the Holy Spirit should be doing things in order, when the revival in the church got started, it should have started in the Vatican, not in the remote parts of any other country. It shouldn't be in Africa or in South Africa or Zimbabwe or Congo. It shouldn't be there. But then God raised these prophets. And when you look at the background of the prophets, you cannot say, well, they have conformed with the criteria, if there is any criteria to being a prophet. You cannot say, oh, they have conformed with the criteria outlined. And that is why we who are learners of religion and theology should not judge, but let God be the judge.
Because
Jesus did say there will be false prophets.
Yes.
People are actually false, but it is not for us to say, oh, you are false.
Well, what about the book of Revelation? I mean, you know, the seer there really rips into people. You know, that Jezebel, and, you know, look at the Nicolaitans, they won't do. So I mean, it's more ambiguous than that in the Bible, isn't it? And I mean, the question of how you discern a false prophet and a true prophet is pretty, I mean, that's a major issue in the Old Testament too, isn't it? So even if he does miracles, even if he does all those things, if he says, let's go worship other gods, you mustn't follow. So just, I mean, there's two principles there. I mean, judge not to be not judged is a terribly, terribly important principle. But it isn't the only one. I just wonder, you talk about the AIC. Well, I mean, I don't know anything about Nigeria, really, very much at all. I mean, I was in Kenya. But can one really generalise? I mean, you've given us the threefold classification of African initiative churches.
Mm.
But, I mean, they are very different. Is the fact that a church is an African instituted church any more significant than if the A stood for America? So an American instituted church is. I mean, when we ask questions about where are the controls, well, can't you say exactly the same thing about American instituted churches? And the problems of people making a lot of money, well, as you quoted Jonesville, didn't you?
Mm.
We get the same sort of problems. I mean, people are arguing about polygamy here. Well, people argue about same-sex relationships in the West. I mean, it seems to me we're all in the same boat here, and obviously the particular issues are going to vary where we are, but...
Yeah, I understand where you are going. I cannot admit that AIC is necessarily permissive.
Let everybody do what they like. I'm just saying, can you really say AIC in the singular at all?
Now, when we say the question of control sometimes can be counterproductive. Control is a good thing. Discipline is good, but sometimes it can be counterproductive. It is like trying to uproot the wheat, and in the process, you damage the good seed.
Yeah, but
can we make this the final point, and then we can go and have a cup of tea and carry on having more points after that?
Mm.
Just on the information, you mentioned that there's a council meeting in Nigeria,
mm.
but your general theme was the international outreach. What are the instruments, what are the institutions, what forms do international dialogues take between the various branches in Africa and in Britain?
Of the cherubim and seraphim. Well, in Britain, for instance, we have our own council, unification council here, and we do have problems because people come to say, well, in a certain church, they are doing terrible things. you must act. You must. The problem is that cherubim and seraphim churches are independently organized. As we are all here, somebody, Emma, can say, I'm fed up with this group, and go down the road and start a church there. So there is no control. We cannot say, hey, you can't do that. That is one of our weaknesses. So when these churches are independently funded and controlled, all we try to do is to harmonize what we do. Not by compulsion, not...
Do you have international meetings?
Yeah, we do.
Between interconciliar?
Yeah.
Between the
countries? Yeah. We observe what goes on in each place, and we try to say, now, people are doing things which can be seen as outside of the doctrine of the church, but can you be careful next time? Don't do this during a divine worship. What you should do during a divine worship and what you should do outside it are different things. So this is the thing that the council can regulate. We do try, but we have no legal mandate to impose control on anyone, because they can do what they like.
Yes, it will still boil down to his question. The parameters which the church, as the ASC, has for what it's called, the control or whatever, whether it's a body of Christians, or unless people are organized in such a way that we'll always have the same problem always. If we are in a church and we decide, I don't like the way you're looking at my sister, and just go down and open a different church, then we, at the end of the day, look like we are trivializing the issue of, which is a very serious issue of God.
Well, let me thank John very, very much for talking about AICs in general, for specifically talking about the cherubim and seraphim, and for answering our comments and questions so robustly. It's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.